All right, boys, just listen up for a sec. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
How does that sound make you feel? Give me some adjectives.
It's nice. It's kind of like reassuring. Steady.
That sounds like a very accurate kind of... I really like the sound of that mechanism.
It's very precise, isn't it?
Yeah. It also makes me feel like I should be somewhere that I'm not. Like I'm in a rush or something.
What have
I
forgotten?
Kind of running late. But it does sound very nice.
I think all of that is very valid, boys. But let me tell you, this is the sound of a British-designed mechanical timepiece from the talented team at Marlowe Watch Company, sponsors of this episode. And with Marlowe, each collection is influenced by a historical story of inspiring human endeavour. Now, I've spent some time at their HQ recently because, well, I'm curious about mechanical timekeeping and also how things work. And I can tell you that there is so much very pleasing attention to detail that goes into each and every watch design. Now, these guys are serious about their watches, and you can tell by looking at some of the watch reviews online. I mean, the words quality and value come up time and again. Visit marlowewatchcompany.com to see for yourself. Marlowe Watch Company, time well spent, which I also like to think could be said for this podcast.
One of the bits of philosophy was like, no one is as smart as everyone together. Right? Like you can sit at your desk banging your head against a problem, but you're much better leveraging all of the learnings and the techniques that everybody has done through history in all these different ways. And that's what this method was trying to distill.
Imagine you had millions of smart little people. They'd run into the bristles and they'd use their little hands to individually grab all the little bits and they'd take those away.
I actually often think that, you know, like you can just clear your desktop online. I'm like, God, I wish I could just press a button and just clear my desktop for real.
Do you know who I picture when we're talking about smart little people? Have you seen Toy Story?
Yes, the army.
Yeah, army figures.
Yeah.
And the way that I think about smart little people interacting is the way those army figures communicate with each other as well, where there's the sergeant who's dishing out the orders.
Exactly.
Right, come on, guys, do this. Hello, and welcome to Sketchplanations, the podcast. A bright, crisp drive, exploring fanciful, gigantic hypotheses in juicy, kind, lemony morsels. Notwithstanding our podcast, quick, ready stories to unwind very well. Xylophones yearn zigzags. I'm Rob Bell. A bit crude. Don't ever forget, guru, high intellect, John O'Hay, knowledgeable. Let me nudge our puzzling quintessential rascal, Super Tom Pellero. This unique visualization will extract your senses. How are you both?
Confused.
What?
Any idea what was going on there?
I was trying to think of a yes, I'm fine, thank you, beginning with an A.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Clever.
It was very clever.
Yeah.
I've never heard anybody do that before.
Well, I was trying to find a name for it because, as we know, with many of the words and kind of alphabetical antics, I've kind of seen them referred to as. You've done quite a few sketches on these things. You've done one on anadiplosis. You've done one on a capitonym. All the other ones, things, homonyms, homographs, homophones, heteronyms, all this kind of stuff. There's loads of sketches on it, but I couldn't find a name for that where you write a sentence or a phrase or a group
in
of sentences.
Successive alphabetical letters or letters of the alphabet. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't find a name.
It's because everybody has to say your senses when they get to the end of it.
I did find some other examples, if you'd like to hear them.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
They do make a bit more sense than the one I did. It feels to me like what you have to do is work back from what you're going to finish your Z word with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or Z or X.
Yeah.
So I found this one on, what did you say that? Quora? Quora?
Quora, yeah.
Quora. This is by a chap called Ken Saladin. Any botanist can describe ecological factors governing horticultural innovatives. Just knowing limited magnesium, nitrogen, or phosphate quantitative requirements, some thoroughly understand very wild xerophytic yellow zinnias.
Wow.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Not very practical, but very clever.
And another one that I quite liked was on the fountainpennetwork.com by someone called Jar. And again, the subject of this is, I think, defined by a word later on. A besotted camel departed early Friday going home. I just kept laughing merrily, noting one person quickly responded, "See that undulating, voyaging wasteland Zebek yonder zooms." And I'm assuming Zebek with an X is maybe a collective word for animals like camels. I don't know.
It is actually something. I don't know. Yeah. That's mad. It's a mad
thing
to do.
No name for it, though. No name for it.
I remember reading this news article. Before the days you could just find it back on the BBC. And it was somebody found a book in their attic where somebody, a member of their family, had written the whole book with words beginning with W.
The whole book?
Yeah, and like, that wouldn't be that spectacular, except it was like 5,000 words long or something like that. All of it beginning with W. W's not bad, actually. You can spin quite a lot long sentences with W. Just give it a try.
Will we walk whilst waiting? No, whilst waiting, that doesn't work.
But yeah, that's the idea. I think it was a story about a whale, as I might imagine.
Who could?
Very clever.
Who could whisper and wink?
Another thing I did find is called a pangram. Have you heard of a pangram before?
Yes, but I've forgotten what it is.
It's a phrase or a sentence that uses every letter in the alphabet.
Yeah. There's another word for those.
And that apparently the one that most people know is the quick brown fox jumps over a lazy dog. Have you heard that before?
That's for typing, isn't it? That's what you do, the typing practice.
Oh, there you go. Talking of like jobs and stuff, you know, this, the alphabetical antic of using every letter consecutively at the beginning of words in a sentence, it kind of feels like this is something that you'd get given for homework to do at school, like, I don't know, third year English or something. And as a kid, you'd be going home, "This is rubbish. Can't believe I've been given this." But as an adult, you'd be like, "Oh, that sounds quite fun." I mean, do you get quite involved in the kids' homework sometimes? Like, "Oh, this is brilliant." And they leave you to it because you're having a great time.
The Jack's just going through his exams at the moment. He's doing a lot of practice papers and things like that. So, and the non-verbal reasoning, which is the kind of shapes and which shape comes next, or the, the ABC and all that sort of stuff. And you're kind of, which one of these fits in, I quite often sit with him and do that, and some of them are really difficult. I sort of remember doing them a little bit at school, but they've really kind of put them on steroids these days, and it's quite challenging.
Yeah, I feel about the same way about those captures. You know, when you're on the internet and it says, "Are you a human?" It gives you a little puzzle.
Yeah,
and I'm like, "Oh, I don't know." Pick all the ones with lampposts in. I don't know. Is this a lamppost or not? I feel like I'm going to fail the human test. Yeah, I know. No, I was impressed with that. A 9-year-old was doing the 13 times table today. I was like, "Oh my God, I don't know the 13 times table." Anybody else know the 13 times?
No. I can get up to 3.
No, yeah, exactly.
It starts getting complicated.
They work them hard.
You know, whatever they might be, palindromes, anagrams, isograms, another one. All good fun, but enough messing around with words and the like. We've a podcast to record, guys. And as the man who hated animals once said, as he instructed others to board the train, "Step on, no pets." That's a palindrome. This week, we're going to be talking about a sketch that introduces a design creativity tool called Smart Little People. It's part of a suite of creativity tools for solving problems using a method called TRIZ. And this tool, Smart Little People, helps designers to overcome obstacles by imagining a team of tiny people all working together doing jobs that could then ultimately be replaced by materials or software or mechanical systems, whatever. Now, if, like me, very little of this seems familiar, then don't worry, because in Tom and Jono, who are both professional and well-experienced designers, we have a couple of experts who can tell us everything we need to know about TRIZ and about the smart little people too. Now, you should be able to see Jono's sketch for this on your screen now, but if not, just follow the link in the podcast description. And before we go deep in on Triz, a little reminder that we'll be going through your correspondence from the last week at the very end of this podcast. And if you'd like to send us a note, and you'd be very welcome to, you can email us.
hello@sketchplanations.com.
Right then, first up, what is Triz? Either of you, Tommy, Jono, what is Triz?
Yeah, I can give a little history of it, and I'd probably say where we learned about it at all, which is we did in Tom and I both did exactly the same degree, pretty much, at Bath University, and we did an advanced design course in our final year, which was really like transforming and really fascinating. It was taught by a really cool teacher called Daryl Mann, and he introduced us to this thing called Triz. And so Triz is a Russian acronym translated into English. It stands for like the theory of inventive problem solving, and it came from, so the story goes, from this guy called, I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong, but Heinrich Altschuler. And he was, I believe, in Azerbaijan, but he got a job working in the patent office, and he was very creative, like, regardless, no doubt. But working in the patent office was, I think, really interesting, because you get patents coming in and you're looking at them. So a patent is you've come up with a design and you want to protect it. So you write down, here's the clever bit about this design, and you submit it so it can be protected so nobody else can copy it. And so you're there reviewing these patents, and everyone that you get is completely different. So they're, you know, one of them's in farming technology, and one of them's in healthcare, and then the next one's in TVs or whatever. And what he noticed, so the story goes, is that across all of these different industries and in all of these different individual innovations, people were solving the same kind of problems in the same kind of ways. And a few different things came out of that. Some is that technology evolved in similar ways across these different industries. And actually, like, if you were in farming tech, well, maybe like TVs is way ahead, and you could actually just borrow some of the ways that the TV technologies evolved and put them in farming. And other ones were, they were solving the same problem if you abstracted it up a little bit, little level up. And so he tried to like codify all this stuff and essentially made a theory of inventive problem solving, so you can like have a design problem and then use some of the tools from Triz to just follow systematically. The idea was always that you just follow systematically a way to get a creative solution to problems.
And so is it a kind of framework to get from problem to some kind of creative inventive solution? It's, yeah, a framework that you can use and can help you along the way.
Yeah, and I think over time it's evolved in all sorts of different ways, but fundamentally, like, there are some principles behind it. Like, here's some ways of thinking that you might use, and then also some methods. It's like, okay, you follow this process, and then there, yep, are some individual tools. And I think that, like, the sketch you picked out today is one of like the individual tools.
Now, I know, like, just surface, tip of the iceberg, and what I know is through you boys and through what I've found out and from what you guys have told me. And it seems really, really interesting, and I really enjoy the fact that I'm aware of it. It does feel, it can feel quite academic at times, I think, and quite heavy. But, you know, as I say, I just know the absolute tip, and I've never used it. But from what I know, it feels like something actually quite a fun process to go through to help you think in ways that you might not get just sat at a desk trying to go, right, come on, be creative, think about this differently.
Yeah, I think the standard thing is, like, I remember one of the bits of philosophy was like, no one is as smart as everyone together, right? Like, you can sit at your desk banging your head against a problem, but you're much better leveraging all of the learnings and the techniques that everybody has done through history in all these different ways. And that's what this method was trying to distill. It's like, let's not me just sit here and maybe I'll get a creative solution, maybe I won't. No, let's follow a solution. Let's figure out what all these other people have done and try and apply those to the problem. Tom and I have had, I don't know, for the last nearly 20 years, a random sort of back channel of chat where wherever we see like some cool thing which just fits bang into Triz, I'll take a picture and send it on. And we've literally been doing that for
20 years. And it's interesting how things have developed and they continue to do so. And we keep on seeing examples like, oh, that's a nice one.
So in reality, in the commercial world, is Triz used? And if so, who's using it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's something that... It's not one of the most common sort of innovation frameworks or anything like that. So, you know, something like design thinking would be, you know, has a much, much stronger take up. It's not something that's massively
Design
studied.
Thinking, is that another kind of framework?
Yeah, and I think maybe one of the other aspects about Triz was based on like technical problem solving, right? So you've got an engineering or a design challenge, and of course if you're working on commercial projects, and this is some of this led to like my PhD topic and all that, was it doesn't matter just about the technical solution. It matters whether or not people like it and people buy it, or whether it fits in with the trends of the time and whether it meets user needs. And so there's all sorts of other aspects, as no doubt Tom can speak to, about what something will make successful. And the technical creative solution is only a part of it. And obviously that's where a lot of these things came from, because they were from patents. So it doesn't tell you actually how to make a hit product, but it might tell you how to solve a problem in a product in a clever way.
So what you said there does kind of ring with what I've read around this a little bit. A, that large commercial companies probably tend not to disclose publicly how they solve their problems for obvious reasons, but it has been reported that Triz has been used by the likes of General Electric, Rolls-Royce, BAE Systems, NASA, Siemens, Ford, General Motors, Procter & Gamble, BMW, Apple, quite technical or tech-heavy companies, I guess.
Yeah, I remember a conference I went to, the best presentation was by some folks at Samsung, right? It's a massive company, so it's not like everybody at Samsung is doing it, but some people were. And they were
right, also- so apparently Samsung have invested heavily embedding Triz into their into what they do. It's used throughout the company. Apparently, even the CEO's been trained in Triz. Apparently, in 2003, Triz led to 50 new patents for Samsung.
Well, certainly also, you can mention my company with Lord Sugar. We use it a lot.
Talk us through that.
Jono and I are fortunate in the fact that, because Daryl Mann was actually only the University of Bath for a couple of years. I then went to work for him for 3 or 4 years and worked in the sort of consulting area for about 5 years before then using it to look at nail files originally. So one of my favorite parts of Triz is this idea of inventive trends that things follow. So for example, one of them is that if something is straight, then there is probably some benefit in it being curved. Like, for example, cars in the 50s, 60s tended to look like a box, didn't they? Mm-hmm. They were just sort of straight edges, straight lines. And now you look at cars and they're hugely curved in multi different directions. Surfboards.
Can I just to put, it's massively simplifying it. But Boeing came out with the Dreamliner recently, and which was, you know, their new massive launch. The main thing it has is curved wings. Curved up wings. And now I'm sure there's a ton of technology and engineering going into that, but in some ways to look at it, you're like, well, duh, the wing was straight. There was probably some advantage in making it. We went around the Museum of Flight the other day, and the back.
Where's that, Johnny?
In Seattle. Mm. And the back of the engines where the exhaust the jet air comes out, they basically just made it like a frilly edge all the way around, and it massively reduced the noise coming out of the engines.
Wow.
And so it's another one where you sort of look at it and you're like, wait a second.
So
I'm sorry, Tom, you were saying surfboards.
So at a really simple level, a hammer. Hammer handles were originally just a straight pole, weren't they, right? Nowadays, hammer handles are all kind of shapes to fit the shape of your hand, because when you go to hit something, it's really useful that it has that sort of curved shape so you can hold onto it more tightly and it doesn't slip out of your hand, right? Milk bottles or bottles used to just be sort of straight-sided bottles, and now they're all curved and they fit into the shape of your hand and they're squeezy and they're kind of, they look more aesthetic and they look nicer. So for my most famous invention, my most famous first invention, was my nail file. Nail files were traditionally always completely straight. I used the Tris trends, and I came up with this idea of a curved shape. I had one that I tested that was a pure boomerang, and that actually wasn't very useful. But the idea of an S shape meant that it fitted in the hand nicer. It followed the natural shape of the nail. You could use the outside of the curve to get closer in underneath the nail. And so this Tris methodology inspired that idea. It was then an unbelievable amount of work to actually bring it to market, and it took me a couple of steps. Took me a couple of tries until I, you know, then went on The Apprentice and did it like that. And it's still today. So I've been working with Lord Sugar for 12 years, and on Amazon, it's still my third best selling product. That curved nail file. It's unbelievable. I've been the curved nail file guy for like 20 years now, and that was inspired by a Tris methodology.
Do both of you use Tris today still in your roles?
Me, certainly. A lot. I don't know if it's sort of become part of my thinking, and I don't spend a huge amount of my time sort of inventing, but another aspect, which I'll let Jono talk about, is contradictions, and maybe actually that's an area that he uses a little bit more.
Is that another a kind of tool within the framework?
So contradictions is one of the sort of fundamental problem solving methods within Tris, and it essentially says, which makes a ton of sense when you think about it, like if you want something to be smaller, let's say, what's stopping you make it smaller? Something is stopping you making something smaller. So if you want it small enough to fit in your pocket, okay, well it's too long, it's too hard, it's too firm, like it's not flexible. And so there's always something that's stopping what you're trying to improve. And so contradiction, a simple example I usually give is if you want a walking pole, then you want the walking pole to be long. So you want it to be like the full length of your leg so that you can touch the ground and it's convenient. But of course that's not very convenient when you get back to the car. So when I'm back to the car, I'd like it short. And when I'm walking, I'd like it long. So
I think I see where we're going here.
I've got a contradiction to solve. And part of Tris says that actually technology moves forward by the resolution of contradictions, where people have found a way to have something some way a bit more without the drawback of the other thing which is opposing that. And so that's the contradiction. There's lots of different
examples. And the thing about the innovative step is that instead of taking the trade-off and being like, oh okay, well I'll make my walking stick sort of long enough that it's okay to use when I'm walking, but short enough that it's okay that it doesn't hit my legs when it's on the back of my bag or when I'm getting into the car. Instead of accepting that trade-off, trying to find a solution that is best in both instances. And I think you also see a lot of contradictions, John, I'm sure, in your UX world, where you want the process to be really slick and fast, but you've got a lot of information to transfer at the same time.
Yeah, anywhere on the web you're finding that kind of thing. Like, do you know the at the bottom of a Mac with all of the programs?
Yeah.
So in the program bar, they're small, and they had a thing, right, which is you move the mouse towards it and they get bigger as you get close to it, right? So that it's easy. I want it to be small so it doesn't take up space, but I want it to be big so it's easy to select. And so you're like, oh. And actually, I mean, software's an unbelievable place to be solving these contradictions, because you can make software do magical things. You know, like I can't just vanish this walking stick when I get to the car, but you can vanish, a window from your screen.
Digitally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually often think that, you know, like you can just clear your desktop on online. I'm like, my God, I wish I could just press a button and just clear my desktop for real. Flip the desk over and be like, right. New tasks, clean desk, but you can't. I often wonder.
Well, you can
translate them.
You can,
I could flip the desk.
Then you got another problem to deal with.
Yeah, well, then I'd have to stick everything down, so it didn't.
And so on that kind of subject, one of the principles that was identified as a solution is what's called blessing in disguise. So talking about your desk, sometimes a cleaner might come into our office and, not knowing, just like clear all my stuff off my desk. And I'll come in the following day and like, oh my gosh, where is all the stuff? But I'll be like, oh, but that is really quite nice. You know, and that's a kind of blessing in disguise, that you didn't mean to have it cleared, but it's all been cleared for you. And actually, did I even know all that stuff? Did I need any of that stuff on my desk? There are lots of lovely blessing in disguise examples, but that's sort of a similar one.
That's nice. And that's almost just a perspective in your mind, an attitude thing, just to look at it differently.
Yes.
Just that it's there, and you can either be annoyed at it, or you can go, oh, actually, that's quite good. There are some benefits.
I had a classic one today. I wrote really quite a long and detailed email with lots of links in, and then my computer crashed because of something. And it's very unusual these days, but I reopened the email and it hadn't saved that quite complicated work I'd done. And I went, you know what? Actually, I'm not sure I needed to share that with them yet. Like, that's probably a bit confusing for them. So I'm not going to redo it. I'm just going to send it as it is and say, you know, we can talk about the details further.
Brilliant. Blessing in disguise. Yeah.
One of the other things you mentioned, like, what is true, is like one of the sort of more philosophical tools. You can do it as a practical exercise. From Triz, I learned, was use of resources.
Yeah.
And so,
say again, use of resources.
Use of resources. So it says, okay, well, what have you got in your system that you can use to solve your problem? And actually, sometimes it's changing the idea that actually this thing which was annoying for you, maybe it could be something that's useful and help solve a problem. And I remember reading just recently, a good friend of ours said that, you know, living down in Devon, there is a big server farm, and so they've got all these computers which are churning out lots of heat all the time. And instead of going, okay, well, we need to bring lots of things in to cool these down, it says, okay, well, actually, maybe we can take that heat, and they're using that heat to send it to a building nearby. And so you go, instead of that being a problem, you say, well, how can that be something that's useful that can help me solve my problem? And that's one way. It's a bit more of a mindset shift. It says, let's not try and be really blunt here and chop everything away. Well, let's just go, well, maybe this could be a benefit to me.
So again, through my research, an example I have you noticed if you've got an internal combustion engine on your car, have you noticed that when you go to fill up now, it's a slightly different experience in a new car to how it used to be? When you used to have to either take your key, so you flip the little bodywork bit back on the hinges, and then you'd unscrew that cap, which sometimes you had to push it, or how much force do you need to push it, which way does it go? And then you'd put the cap on the roof of your car or on the top of the petrol pump, and then you fill up, and then you either forget to put it back on, or you can't get it back on, or you get your hands covered in petrol when you're putting it back on. Apparently Triz was used for the solution which you see on most cars now, where you haven't got the cap that you have to take off anymore. It's a spring loaded flap on the fill nozzle from the underside.
I mean, that's the thing with like creative solutions. When as soon as you hear them, you're like, "Yeah, well, of course." You're like, "But why wouldn't you do that?" Yeah, and yet people were making cars, you know, for 100 years without finding that solution.
Yeah, the example in Devon you're talking about there, using the heat from a server farm to actually using that heat rather than just dispelling it, and then actually probably using more energy to cool the servers down.
Mm.
Do you think Triz would be a useful tool to help find more climate solutions?
Most definitely. And I'm sure those that are involved are using Triz along with other tools. You know, there are many, many innovation tools out there and frameworks, you know, from your sort of brainstorming to your De Bono six hats to your, as Jono just mentioned, and ways of thinking, and then very creative people who are also sort of very observant and follow through a process. Jono and I were fortunate enough to learn about Triz, and I personally think it's incredibly powerful. I do really struggle to explain it though, or because it can become a bit too baffling, and it's especially useful in kind of technical situations. But the trends and the innovation principles, are everywhere and are very useful to consider in different ways.
Mm. Well, let's get on to the sketch, but the principal sketch at least, which is a bit of a different format this week, listeners, but I felt it's quite important to talk about Triz and understand that before we get into one of these talks. By the way, has Bono really only got six hats?
Dad joke.
So the sketch... Yeah, that's awful. So the sketch that is the principal sketch that you should be able to see on your screens is called Smart Little People, as I said at the beginning of the pod here. So talk to me a little bit about this Smart Little People tool, because the reason I wanted to do it from the podcast is because it sounds really fun, and it's a really fun little thing to visualise. You're just dropping in this little army of guys that, right, guys, get to it, fix it.
Yeah, I think, well, let me just see, I'll explain what the sketch is. So it's just a problem solving tool, Smart Little People. And the example I gave, well, it says, if your system was made of smart little people, how would they solve the problem? And I was trying to give this example of blood clotting, because I remember this from, you know, my GCSE biology, which was the way these essentially like strands form over the top of a cut. And it's the strands almost like a little net that starts to stop the blood hitting it. And obviously it clots and congeals and things as well. But first of all, you just stop holding the net going through. So I've got a little picture of these little people on either side of a gap pulling something across. And it was meant to be stopping all my little platelets escaping, because I've just cut myself. But I think like one of the fundamental things is, and why Smart Little People is quite fun, is most things that we interact with are pretty dumb. As I say, they're not like software, you know, like they don't do anything special. They're just a surface. And so this is sort of encourages you to go, well, actually, maybe we can make this more intelligent. Maybe we can make this place smarter. Perhaps it needs to, you know, protect against heat, or maybe it needs to stick together. And instead of it being like just a dumb surface, what would a smart little people encourages you to go, well, maybe this could be quite intelligent, and they could be, you could be solving the problem right down at a teeny little level. It's one of the, it's a nice phrase actually, psychological inertia tools from that we learned from Triz, and I think the Synectics problem solving method has something a bit similar. And psychological inertia is a standard sort of thing. Is people get stuck, and there's some really fun experiments around this, but people get stuck thinking about the problem the same way. And you, as I say, you're banging your head, I can't see another way in. And then this is one of the tools to give you a different way of looking at the problem to maybe spark some new ideas.
So I've got a lovely example of this, which might be helpful.
Go
as
on,
well.
Tommy.
Okay, so
paint us a picture.
Cleaning a makeup brush, right? For hundreds of years, people have been cleaning their makeup brushes, or cleaning any kind of brushes, by putting it in water, dabbing it out, getting their fingers inside, trying to open the bristles up, trying to like flick around, then getting towel and doing that. Okay, so then you kind of go, well, imagine you had millions of smart little people. What would they do? They'd run into the bristles and they'd use their little hands to individually grab all the little bits, and they'd take those away, right? And they'd open all the bristles up so you could get right into each different bristle. Well, I don't have little people, so is there another way that I can apply force only to the mug? And how can I open up all the bristles? And actually, in that instance, I happened to have a nail drill beside me, because I was looking into, this is a motor that spins. I was like, what if I use that to spin the makeup brush? And what that does is it spins the makeup brush on its axis, and then all that makeup and dirt is acted upon by centrifugal force, which is just like millions of little people going in there to pull the stuff out. And also, every single bristle in itself is spun outwards by the centrifugal force, as if you've got lots of smart little people fanning the brush out for you. So
nice.
The spinning effect is doing both things that the smart little people would do for you, which is, one, opening up all the bristles, and secondly, just taking all the muck, all the dirt, all the bacteria off all those individual ones. And I can't believe that no one had ever thought of doing that before. And possibly it was because of smart little people that made me think. And it was definitely because of use of resources or serendipity. And it was probably a lot to do with serendipity that I had this thing next to me and I got some sellotape and I put it all together and was like, oh my gosh, this works. And then the blessing in disguise, the amazing thing, was then when I lifted the brush up out of the liquid, it sprayed all over me, kind of thing, but it sprayed everything off. And it's like, oh my gosh. And it turned out that actually for people, drying of a makeup brush was actually more important or more difficult than cleaning it in the first place. So it's a combination of loads of things, but it's a very nice framework tool or psychological tool, or, you know, and created something that we've now sold millions of.
You used Smart Little People when you invented that, did you? In your mind, along with other tools?
One of the TRIZ principles is, you know, spinning something or using another dimension. I'm fortunate because I've been using it for 20 odd years. That's just how my brain works.
That's quite cool. It's like driving a car, right? You don't think about foot on clutch, put into gear, release clutch, handbrake, mirror signal, maneuver. Yeah. You just do it. That's what your brain's doing with TRIZ when you come up against a problem. That's pretty cool, that, Tommy.
Thank you.
That's pretty. No wonder your eyes are so manic whenever you're thinking.
It's a smart little people all running around inside.
Do you know who I picture when we're talking about smart little people? Have you seen Toy Story?
Yes, the army.
Yeah. You know the little army figures? I think about them. And the way that I think about smart little people interacting is the way those army figures communicate with each other as well.
Exactly.
Where there's the sergeant who's dishing out the orders. Right, come on, guys, do this.
Another great example is Teflon coatings or something on a frying pan. You know, and you can sort of view that as millions of smart little people with their little, you know, with their shields up, that you can't damage me, you can't get through me. And it was that kind of way of thinking that it's a nice example of that surface coating.
There's the classic example, it came from like copy in nature, but the Velcro one, right? Velcro came from the burrs sticking on the dog's fur, and you're like, oh, well, these little curved burrs sticking on the fur, and you're like, but Velcro is one of the where you can just imagine. It's like, well, if I have like a surface which is a bit furry, well, how would I stick this other surface to it? Well, I'd grab on with these hooks, and I'd have loads and loads of these little hooks with these little people grabbing on. And I just think Velcro's, you know, a bit like that. I was thinking, you know, fundamentally, we talk about contradictions. It's just something like Gore-Tex, right? Like breathable fabrics are such a classic thing. But first of all, you've solved this, you're massively trying to solve this contradiction, which is, I want to keep the water out, but I want to let air through it.
Yeah.
Is that right? Or alternatively,
keep the water on the outside. You want porous, non-porous.
Yeah.
So I want to breathable, but not waterproof. Yeah.
An amazing contradiction there. Is it a classic example of one? And their solution, Johnny?
Well, I don't know what the magic of something like Gore-Tex is, but I just imagine, like, if I made out of smart little people, I'd be like, okay, you know, let the air through, but stop all the water. How would they do that?
But as you say, when you say it out loud, you're like, that's impossible. And that's what most people probably thought. Well, that's impossible. No one can do that. Let's move on. But then if you look into it a little bit more, an air molecule is a bit smaller than a water molecule. So if you make loads of really small holes, then actually air could come out, especially with heat and with sort of the force of the heat, but water can't get in. And I think also there's something special about the shape of the hole potentially, and when you start getting down to it's an incredible material, but it was probably born from that realization that a contradiction is solvable, it's not just about a trade-off, and secondly, start looking into it in more kind of detail and more nuance.
It's brilliant. And I love how fluently you guys speak about all this as well, because you've got so much experience using it. It's lovely. It's really enjoyable to sit back and listen to.
One of the things I like, and I remember looking at lots of different solutions, is like natural pest control. And I think that's a great example. When you mentioned about your little soldiers, I think of those as very, you know, natural pest control is very much smart little people. Like, you know, I've got a field of crops and I've got all these bugs on individual leaves. How on earth am I going to do that? Well, I literally am going to send in smart little insects in this case to go in and pick each one off individually. But so you'd never be able to do that with something like physical or mechanical. And I was thinking, yeah, the natural pest control things are kind of amazing. It's a bit like when you go, oh, I want to, you know, keep this patch of grass short. Well, sometimes the easiest thing is to get some goats or something, or sheep.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're not little people, they're just animals. But
if I may, Rob, am I allowed to take us on to another sketch?
Yeah, you can.
Is Nine Windows, which is this concept that a lot of the time design is just focusing on the product in its main use case. So, for example, yeah. A bicycle. I get really quite frustrated with bikes because they seem to only really be invented or created for when you are cycling, when you're taking them. They're not. No one, in my opinion, really thinks about, apart from Brompton maybe, about what happens when you get that bike home. Like, mm-hmm. You live in a flat in London and you get your bike and you have to put it in the front door and the pedals just catch on everything. The wires catch on everything. The handlebars on literally everything.
Wheel turns.
Oil up the wall.
Scrape oil up your trousers from the chain.
So you're not thinking about, and so the concept of Nine Windows is your middle window is your kind of standard, your main use case of when you're using it to cycle along. But what about afterwards? What about before? What about the macro, the kind of the bigger system that it sits within, potentially rain and stuff? What about the micro? What about the details within it, like the oil, the fact that that chain is going to go? And I really, really work on my own personal thinking and those around me's thinking. So, you know, we talked about my curve nail file at the beginning. One of the things we did is adding some tools, because before you file or after you file, you might want to clean underneath the nail. So we built in a little nail cleaner that goes underneath, so it uses the plastic and it works. And there's also a cuticle pusher at the other end of it, sort of trying to think about the before and the after. And a lot of the products that we now design, like our travel mirror, it comes with a really nice case to put it in, so that, because mirrors are so easy to damage and you want a nice case. You don't want to have to then store it carefully. So it's a very powerful way of thinking actually in product design and many other fields.
Yeah, I realized I put on the sketch just practice thinking in space and time, and that, which Nine Windows is just a template to make you do that. But just that phrase is quite powerful, I think, isn't it? Practice thinking in space and time. We always spend, as Tom says, like you're on the here and now, the problem. But what about the rest of it? You know, I think that's really cool. We should all do that.
I think to think of the space and time, I always want to say the space-time continuum. Yeah. I'm back to the future when I do that. But to think about space and time collectively, rather than as two separate entities, because a lot of the time, if you've got a problem, it will be defined by one of those dynamics, right? Space or time, dimension, sorry, or probably others as well that I can't necessarily think of. So it's very easy to just think in that one dimension. Boys, I think I'm going to leave it there on Triz and Smart Little People, unless there's any benefits of it that you'd like to tell us about, either Triz or Smart Little People.
We could literally talk about this for hours, and we could take individual tools. We could, you know, go to an outdoor store. I think the clearest example of a lot of the Triz stuff is like outdoors equipment, because in outdoor Brilliant. Equipment the performance and the constraints are so key. That, you know, if you've got an ice axe, it's not okay to have just like a cool looking ice axe. No, it needs to do the job as well as an ice axe can do when you're on a mountain. And so that's a great place to look at all of these inventive principles being applied. But we could talk about them for hours, so we should probably leave it there.
I think, John, am I right in saying that you've probably got a few sketches on some different Triz tools, not just the Smart Little People, and Nine Windows? Is Nine Windows one of the sketches?
Yeah, I think I've got at least four other sketches from Tristles. Yeah, I could probably keep going.
Well, if anyone's interested, I will pop them up in the podcast description. I will pop links to those in the podcast description so you can check those out as well. But as I said, boys, it's really enjoyable for me listening to you guys talk in detail about this stuff. It's obviously really important to you, something that you both have a real passion for. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you all very much for listening. And if there's one of Jono's sketches up at sketchmanations.com that you'd like us to cover that we haven't yet, then let us know. I mean, what is it? 16 episodes in series one, and we're already well on our way in series two. But there's loads up there, hundreds, literally hundreds. If you'd like us to cover one, ping it over to us. We'll be back in just a moment, though, to go through the postbag from last week. But for now, thanks again for listening. Go well, stay well. Goodbye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Welcome back. And we've got time for a couple of messages about the car and driving on the road compilation. I like calling it that. So we've had an email from Jez, who says that the episode particularly resonated with him because he's an automotive engineer, which is fantastic. However, he points out a correction, not really a correction, a clarification, I should say, that a piston on its own can't turn reciprocating motion into a rotary motion. You need a connecting rod and a crankshaft, which, yes,
and a pivot
you
point.
Do.
Yeah, I'd say it's a correction. We should have remembered that.
We could have been more specific about that. But yes, Jez, obviously you're right. Thank you for pointing that out. He says he's sure he's not the only one who's going to point this out, but probably the only one with enough engineering geekery, wait for it, to have a tattoo of a piston. And he sent us a photo of his tattoo of a piston. On his arm. That's on his gun, isn't it? That's on the inside of his bicep.
Very cool.
Very cool, Jez. Thank you, mate. That's got me thinking. Had another message from @treacle75 on Instagram. They've identified when they use their car horn for two items, either for saying, "Oi, idiot," or "It's green." They say they have no hesitation in using it, and they've again clarified that no, they don't drive a BMW, which was nice to have as well, that clarification. Thank you very much, Treacle75. We've also had a couple of messages about our episode, The Four Pillars of Too Much, episode two, from a couple of weeks ago. And Simon kicks off with an email. Who basically backs up everything that we were talking about last week. It says, so true about cramming too much in. I have a pile of unread books, a long list of unwatched programs in my list on Netflix, a lot of podcasts I've subscribed to but never have the time to listen. Then there's the music I want to play, the guitar I bought to learn but never play. We put a lot of pressure on ourselves and then feel frustrated that we haven't achieved what we thought we could in the time available. I mean, yeah, it's... We covered so much of this last week. And he goes on to say that his wife's often saying to him to just go for a walk without headphones, or to do the gardening or DIY without having something in his ears the whole time. And this is off the back of what you were talking about. I can't remember who asked it last week. It was either you, Tommy, or Jono. It says, think about when was the last time you spent 10 minutes or half an hour just doing nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I think that obviously resonated with Simon there.
And thank you, TA, on email. I really like the section about the news. I think I'm probably the most ill-informed person there is when the news is concerned. But how you used to keep up with the news via the sort of news at 10, but then with COVID and the wars, just sort of all found it just so depressing that sort of just kind of turned off from it. And now, you know, really doesn't really watch or catch up. I must admit, for Lent last year, I didn't read the news or watch the news at all for a month.
You gave up news?
I gave up news as my for Lent, instead of chocolate, which I normally do. And I must admit, I did find it quite liberating.
What was harder? What's harder, giving up news or giving up chocolate, that you've done both on different years for Lent?
Oh, what's harder? I suspect actually giving up the news is harder, because it's just what it's that sort of habit, because you've always got your phone. It's just a habit just to have a look at it the whole time. Whereas chocolate, I sort of don't feel like I'm eating chocolate until the afternoon at the earliest. Giving up both is definitely would be the hardest.
I think Lent still applies if it's the afternoon.
No, but as in I don't normally eat chocolate in the morning. Oh, that's a lie. I eat from any time after 11. But back to the point here. Also like the bit about doing nothing, which I think a lot of us have shared, ironically. And he has an ice bath, which he does 3 to 4 times a week. And he thinks that maybe one of the reasons he finds the ice bath so powerful is because he says you literally can't think of anything else other than trying to control your breathing when you get into an ice bath, because you're in kind of such pain and
breathing.
Not to do that. Yeah,
I mean that is something that we've seen resonated in the correspondence that we've had. That it was a kind of throwaway comment, a little bit, Johnny. It wasn't a main feature of just doing nothing for a while, but it's really resonated with people. There's just no time for it, is there?
There's no time to do nothing.
Thank you all very much for all of your correspondence, however it comes in, whether it's through our email or on social media or however. Keep it coming. We love to hear from you, and we read through all of them. We don't always have the time to read them all out on the podcast, but I can assure you everything that you send in is read by all of us. Thank you so much indeed. We'll be back next week. Cheerio. All music on this podcast series is sourced from the very talented Frank Cinelli. And you can find loads more tracks at frankcinelli.com.